This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Introducing Anthroposophical Medicine, Lecture 15, given in Dornach on April 4th, 1920. Yesterday, someone who is very competent in this regard commented to me that of all anthroposophical lectures, these are among the most difficult to understand. I would like to begin today by addressing this comment. Within certain limits, we must certainly admit that it is true. But we will also have to admit that the difficulties are almost unavoidable. In my opinion, however, the very fact that this comment is justified can teach us a great deal. Let us take a case where what I have to say is very easy to understand, or even two cases, one of which is very near at hand, and the other somewhat less accessible to modern humanity. With regard to the first, more obvious example, people of our current cultural epoch are justified in experiencing difficulty in understanding subjects like the ones that are presented here. A blackbird, however, has no such difficulty. A blackbird would find all of this readily understandable, and would even offer practical proof of being able to comprehend it. Blackbirds, which are not, after all, totally ascetic animals, occasionally eat cross spiders. Footnote: cross spider, Epeira diadema, is a common European garden spider with a cross-like marking on its back. End of footnote. But when a blackbird eats a cross spider and begins to feel very uncomfortable, which is what happens when blackbirds eat cross spiders, it heads straight for a henbane plant. If there is a henbane plant nearby, the blackbird will go straight to it to get the appropriate remedy. If no henbane is available, the blackbird develops convulsions and dies a terrible death. Footnote: henbane, Hyoscyamus niger, black henbane, or stinking nightshade. End of footnote. Its own healing instinct, however, protects it from this fate. It immediately begins pecking away at henbane, the appropriate remedy. This is the very obvious example. Another related process, however, is less accessible to modern human beings. At a certain time in the distant past, humans developed healing instincts like this, and these instincts encompassed aspects of what we encounter in a more or less concentrated form in Hippocratic medicine. It is interesting to study the wisdom of blackbirds, or of other birds, who can do the same thing in many instances, with reference to the very justified comment that was made yesterday. What is actually going on when a blackbird eats a cross spider? The cross spider's entire organization is closely linked to certain cosmic relationships in supra-earthly nature, and this connection gives rise to its overall limb development as well as to its markings. If I may put it in this way, the cross spider has a lot of planetary life in it. In contrast, birds have lagged behind in experiencing planetary events, which they have shifted toward the interior of the organism. When a bird swallows a cross spider, the planetary forces make themselves felt inside the bird. These planetary forces, which still have the tendency to assume form, attempt to pervade the bird, which then has to combat this process. As soon as the bird has consumed the garden spider, its inner will becomes a copy of supra-earthly life, and it goes straight to a specific plant. This plant has become similar to earthly factors, the opposite of the planetary factors, because of the very way it grows out of the earth, specifically because of its inability to fully process a substance influenced by the planets, which it retains as a poison instead. The bird goes straight to this plant for help, because as soon as the spider toxin begins to work in the blackbird, it summons up the bird's counter-instinct, its defensive instinct. There is an immediate transition from instinctive response to injury to the defensive instinct, so the entire phenomenon is nothing less than a very elastic elaboration on what we ourselves do if a fly gets in one of our eyes and we blink or move a hand in the simple reflex gesture. It is extremely important for us to observe these processes in the plant and animal kingdoms, because it cures us of the belief that reason and common sense are contained only within our own skulls, when in fact they must also be flying around outside, since very rational behavior is evident in the bird's instinctive self-defense against injury. We human beings simply have the gift of being able to participate in the workings of outer reason and common sense. We engage in them. But it is nonsense to imagine that we carry them within ourselves. A bird does not yet participate in these workings, in the sense of having a specific body part for acquiring the instinct to respond defensively to injury. To understand what is inside us, we human beings use the head system, whereas birds still use the lung system for this purpose to a greater extent. Because a bird's thinking is less peripheral and lies closer to the core of its being, its lung system produces the defensive instinct against hyoscyamus. I'm going to spell that. It's H-Y-O-S-C-Y-A-M-U-S, excuse me. In contrast, we humans have forcibly removed our thinking from our lungs and rhythmic system. Perhaps we will have time to speak more specifically about what human beings use for thinking, but in any case, we no longer think so centrally. Unlike birds, we do not think with our lungs and heart, and so on. Our thinking is no longer so connected to the cosmos. We must relearn such cosmic thinking. If you ask what eliminated the final remnants of the instincts that connected us to nature, we must say that our schooling and our university education did this to us. Such things are fundamentally predisposed to preventing us from living in harmony with nature as a whole. They drive us into refined intellectuality on the one hand and refined sexuality on the other. In modern humankind, something that was central to primeval humanity is being driven apart into these two poles. You see, in order to find our way back to a proper understanding of the universe, we must regain our health in the realm of scientific activity. Unfortunately, many subjects are currently being studied only by means of an unhealthy science. They will have to be studied by pursuing science in a healthy way. Next, in connection with what I said yesterday, we will concern ourselves a bit with observing the human being in a way that points directly toward the relevant healing process. This mode of observation was so highly developed among primeval human beings that the appearance of anything abnormal in an individual immediately directed them to the appropriate healing process. This ability has been lost to modern human beings. Our intuition is unlikely to discover what primeval human beings discovered through instinct. This is simply a matter of evolution, which proceeds from instinct through intellectualism to intuition. Physiology and medicine, however, are among the fields that suffer most in the purely intellectual stage of evolution, and are at least able to flourish in the atmosphere of intellectualism, and are least able to flourish in the atmosphere of intellectualism. Let us take a concrete example, a case of diabetes. As an abnormal development, what does diabetes represent? First of all, we can acquire true insight into diabetes only when we recognize it as weakness of the I, capital, an inability of the I organization to cope with the whole process of sugar formation as it is meant to take place. We must simply interpret the phenomena in the right way. It would be totally wrong to believe that because sugar is being excreted, we are dealing with an I that is too strong. No, in this case the I does not participate forcefully enough in the organic process to be able to supply and pervade the individual's organization with sugar in the appropriate way. This is the initial phenomenon. And everything that works to promote diabetes is related to it. We can perceive a first sign of diabetic illness if someone simultaneously eats too many sweets and drinks alcohol. This first sign may disappear again, of course, but it does show how the eye-weakening process is initiated. The eye cannot cope with what really ought to be taking place. At the moment, it is important for us to look at these phenomena. This leads me to a concept that has not come up much in the course of our studies. Since it does appear on many of our lists of questions, we will enter into it in more detail in the remainder of these lectures. Your questions will all be considered, but first, appropriate preparation is necessary. The concept I am approaching here is that of hereditary predisposition, which plays a major role in diabetes in particular. This hereditary predisposition does indeed have an effect on a weak eye. We can always confirm the connection between a weak eye, or rather an eye that is not functioning with all its complexes of forces, and predisposition to inherited illnesses. If it were simply a question of hereditary predisposition, we would all be suffering from illnesses of this sort. That this is not the case is essentially due to the fact that someone with a well-functioning eye is less likely to suffer from them. On the other hand, we must not overlook the fact that psychological causes are often present in diabetes to a greater or lesser extent, and that its appearance can be linked to stressful stimulation in high-strung individuals. Why is this so? When the eye is weak, it tends to restrict its activity to the periphery of the organism, where it develops a strong intellectualism via the brain. This weak eye, however, is not capable of penetrating deeper into the organism, and specifically into those parts of the organism where protein is processed, where plant protein is transformed into animal protein. The activity of the eye does not extend to this process. In its place, the astral body becomes all the more active, because the astral body's activity is greatest where digestion, blood formation, and respiration interact in the middle organizational process. Because of the inability of the eye, this middle process is left to its own devices and begins to develop all sorts of obstinately independent processes that relate only to the middle region of the human being rather than to the totality. We can say that predisposition to diabetes occurs if the eye excludes itself from internal processes. These internal processes, especially that of secretion, are strongly related to the development of feelings or emotions. All of this secretion, which, as you know, is an oscillating and circulating activity, is neglected, while the eye is focusing its chief activity on the brain. As a result, the person in question loses control over certain psychological influences that assert themselves in the form of emotional influences. Why can we remain calm when something exciting occurs around us? It is because we have the ability to send our reason into our guts, because we are really in a position to engage the whole person instead of remaining only in the brain. While we are thinking, we cannot do this. While we are busy in the one-sided intellectual way that comes from the brain, the inner part of the body is engaged in its own movements. We are then extremely susceptible to stressful stimuli. Consequently, these stimuli also evoke their organic processes intellectually, while they should be doing something else. Stimuli that work on our feeling life should not evoke their organic processes without first being pervaded by the intellect. They should be subdued by reason before working on the interior of the human being. It is important to realize that in a situation like this, we are encountering a labile I, and that the I is related to the most supra-earthly factors in the human being, to the factors that are most peripheral to the earth. In reality, everything that is active in our I approaches us from far beyond the earth. Thus, we must try to become familiar with activities that are related to these supra-human processes having to do with our I, so that we become able to shift the I into a realm where it learns to participate appropriately in supra-earthly factors. Within the earthly element, the equivalent of the super-earthly influence that leads the I to work on its inner central organization causes either the mineral part of the earth or its plants to form etheric oils or oils of any sort. Just as the human eye becomes active in the eyes, coming into direct connection with the outer world through this gulf, it must also be brought into connection with the oil-forming process. We can probably do this best by attempting to incorporate finely dispersed oil into therapeutic baths. It would be very desirable to investigate what degree of dispersion is required, how often the baths should be administered, and so on. This is how diabetes' devastating attack on the organism should be counteracted. You can see here how observing an outer process and associating it with an internal human process creates a human supra-human physiology that is also a therapy at the same time. This is the path we must take if we want to achieve anything at all in this regard. After we acquire some additional, more concrete concepts, I would like to point out once again how human beings actually relate to the environment. Please consider how the totality of the earth's plant life grows upward, dispersing its forces in the flowers and gathering them together again in the fruits. Consider, too, all the thousands of strange variations of this process that exist. Perhaps something that ordinarily shoots entirely into the seeds is retained in leaf development, making the plants thick and cabbage-like. Or perhaps the seed pods thicken because certain forces are held back at the very last minute. There are all kinds of possible variations. The process of plant development, however, should truly not be considered only from the perspective of the physical effects of the earth and the counter-effects of light. While it is certainly true that a plant incorporates a physical and an etheric body and is entirely subsumed by them, it is equally true that up where the supra-earthly collides with the earthly, there is a cosmic astrality related to this plant. We might say that the plant grows upward toward, but cannot attain, an animal process of development. The interior of the earth is saturated with the plant-forming process, while the atmosphere toward which plants grow is saturated with an animal-forming process, which plants approach but cannot attain. The process we see taking place here weaves above the flowering plant world, where it has a circumferential or peripheral relationship to the entire earth. This same process, however, is centralized and internalized in animals. Animals split off and incorporate the activities that take place above plants. The organs that animals have and plants do not are nothing other than what animals claim for themselves. Something that is otherwise developed on the periphery and directed at plants from outside is developed from a central point outward by animals. This animal-forming process is also present in human beings, but is located closer to the center of the physical human organization. It tends more in the direction of the interaction of digestion, blood formation, and respiration, where the process shaping the human being is most similar to today's animal-forming process. This is also why the interior of the physical body is the part of the human being most closely related to the vital processes of the plant kingdom, and why we can always count on being able to treat the interior of the human body with derivatives of vital processes that manifest in the plant kingdom. Human beings, however, have an advantage over the animal kingdom. This advantage is based on the fact that the humans undergo not only the interaction that takes place in animals between the plant and astral elements, but also one that takes place between the mineral element and an element that is super-astral, that is, even farther out on the periphery than the merely astral element. Thus we can say that the specifically human attribute at the present stage of the Earth's evolution is to participate in the mineral-forming process. Just as protein transformation takes place in animals, another process, one that science does not take into account at all, takes place in human beings. This process tends to move toward the periphery. Excuse me, let me read that again. This process tends more toward the periphery than the animal activity of transforming protein, happening, if we may put it like this, between the heavens and the mineral kingdom. If we want to have a term for it, we can call it a desalinizing process, in accordance with its chief characteristic. You see, in the human organism, a desalinizing process is continually taking place, a tendency to transform salt formation into its opposite. This is the true basis of our humanness, and especially of our human thinking, which transcends animal existence. In our peripheral aspect, although not in our central aspect, which is similar to animal formation, we resist the formation of salt. We counteract salt formation just as animals counteract the ordinary earth-forming forces of plant protein. We must seek out the forces inherent in this counteraction, preferably in the mineral kingdom, in order to be able to cure certain conditions in human beings that we cannot successfully treat with phytotherapeutics. I might say that we see human beings as mere animals if we attempt to treat them exclusively with plant-derived remedies. We respect people's humanness by asking them to take part in the fiercer battle against the mineralization of the earth, a battle that goes on in the earth's surroundings. And by allowing the eye to participate in this battle, when we make it possible for an individual to become involved in it. Each time we treat a person with silica, we are appealing to that person's silica-splitting forces, to the ability to overcome this hard mineral. By doing so, we enable the eye to engage vigorously in a process that no longer takes place on Earth at all. The forces prevailing outside the earthly sphere attempt to fragment everything that is earthly and solid in universal space. The universe has the peculiarity of smashing to pieces everything that aggregates and solidifies in the planetary realm. In everyday life, we seldom participate in this process, which is usually confined to universal space. The people who participate in it the most are mathematical personalities, people who are accustomed to living in the world of numbers and thinking in terms of mathematical forms. Their kind of thinking is based on smashing the mineral element to pieces. In contrast, people with a certain distaste for mathematics want to restrict themselves to a mere desalinizing process and cannot become agents of internal destruction. This is the difference between mathematical and non-mathematical personalities. Counteracting the Earth's mineralizing process is the basis of many ideas about the therapeutic process. Once again, these are things that were simply part of primeval humanity's instinctive, defensive response to injury. When primeval human beings noticed any sign of their thinking becoming weak, they turned to some mineral substance, which they took. By breaking down this mineral substance internally, they once again acquired the ability to be in harmony with supra-earthly factors that are very far removed from the earth. It is possible to trace processes in the natural world outside the human being in a way that permits direct observation of the validity of statements such as this. Let us do this by considering a plant that is extremely interesting in this regard, Betula alba, or white birch. Footnote, the European white birch is now called Betula pendula. Betula alba can refer to either that, more likely, or to Betula papyrifera, American white birch, paper or canoe birch, papyrifera maybe, P-A-P-Y-R-I-F-E-R-A, excuse me. End of footnote. White birch counteracts or refuses to participate in the normal process of plant development in two ways. The usual process of plant development would come about if you could mix what happens in birch bark with what happens in birch leaves, especially the young spring leaves that still have a trace of brown in them. If you could mix these two separate processes and make the active principle in birch bark work together with the active principle in birch leaves, you would get a wonderful herbaceous flowering plant. The birch tree comes about simply because the processes that arise during the living formation of protein are carried into the leaves to a greater extent than is normal. The protein-forming process is concentrated in the leaves, while the process of potassium salt formation is preserved in the bark. In a plant that remains herbaceous rather than becoming a birch tree, the process of potassium salt formation mingles with the process of protein formation in the plant's roots. In the birch tree, what the roots take from the earth is forced outward into the bark, while the leaves receive what a herbaceous plant would mingle with what comes from the earth. Thus the birch tree works on the human organism from two different directions, through its bark, which contains the appropriate potassium salts. It works in cases where the patient's desalinizing processes need to be stimulated, as in skin rashes, for example. What shoots outward into the bark in the birch tree also shoots outward in the human being, where it has a therapeutic effect. But if you take the leaves which preserve the protein-forming forces, you get the birch factor that influences the center part of the human being, where it proves to be a good remedy for gout and rheumatism. If you want to further enhance the process, you can take the mineral aspect of the birch's development by producing charcoal from birch wood. Then you get therapeutic forces that work in a strong internal and external way on the outside of the human interior, that is, on the intestines and so on. We must learn to see a plant's effect on the human being from its external form. If you study Betula alba, you can say that if we wanted to transform this birch into an image in the human being, so that it would make the entire human being healthy, we would turn it inside out and incorporate the forces that surge into the wood and bark, into the human skin, the periphery, while we would take what the birch sends outward and apply it to the interior of the human being. We would turn the entire birch tree inside out in the human being, as an image, mind you. This is meant to provide you with an image, in such a way that we can trace the healing forces it offers to the human being. When you look at plants with very pronounced root development, plants that develop very strong root forces that then deposit potassium and sodium salts in the plants, you find that this tendency to hold fast to the roots has a healing effect on internal bleeding and also on the formation of kidney stones and so on. Shepherd's purse, Capsula bursa pastoris, is one plant that might be useful in these conditions and everything lying between. Think your way as well into a plant such as Cochlearia officinalis, common scurvy grass or spoonwort. This plant is also interesting to study. Through the sulfur contained in its oils, it is able to work directly on its own proteins. In the mineral realm, sulfur works on protein by enhancing its formative forces. If the process of protein formation is too sluggish, it can be speeded up through the addition of the sulfur process, which is essentially what a plant such as spoonwort develops in an organic form. The fact that spoonwort grows in specific locations, that it is introduced into nature in a very particular way, condemns it to develop excessively sluggish protein processes. A wonderful instinct of nature balances this with the plant's sulfur-containing oils, which counteract sluggish processes of this sort. A protein process that has been speeded up is something different from a protein process that proceeds at a natural pace. We must always take this into account. You can find protein-forming processes in many different plants that proceed just as quickly as those in spoonwort, but they do not come about through the interaction of a sluggish principle and an accelerating principle. A constant interaction of this sort in the growth of spoonwort makes it inwardly related to and especially suited for use in diseases such as scurvy, because the process that takes place in scurvy is extremely similar to the one I have just described. I believe we can actually get quite far by training ourselves to think of outer natural events in conjunction with events within the human being in this particular way. This thinking leads us to these extremely important relationships. But it also leads to an understanding of the human being that cannot be acquired in any other way, because the human being can be understood only from the perspective of what is external to the human being, while the external can be understood only from the perspective of the human being. We must be able to study these two things in conjunction with each other. I hope you will not find it extraneous if I conclude today's lecture with a topic that will help us with subsequent observations, namely the peculiar way the spleen functions in the human organism. Human spleen function tends very strongly toward the spiritual aspect. This is why I once said in a lecture cycle on esoteric physiology that if you remove the spleen, the etheric body, that is the etheric spleen, takes its place very easily, so that this is one of the human organs that can be most readily replaced by its etheric counterpart. Footnote: these lectures took place March 20th through the 28th, 1911, in Prague, and it is Collected Works number 128. End of footnote. The spleen, however, is less closely related than the other human abdominal organs to metabolism as such. What is the spleen actually? To spiritual scientific research, the spleen presents itself as the organ that is called upon to create constant harmony between crude metabolism and all the more soul-like or spiritualized processes in the human being. The spleen, and this is basically true of all other organs to a greater or lesser extent, is a strong subconscious sensory organ. And it reacts extremely strongly to the rhythm of food intake. Constant eating induces a totally different kind of spleen activity than leaving intervals between meals. We can observe this particularly in the irregular spleen activity that develops in children who snack constantly. We can also see it in the fact that when eating does not intervene, after we fall asleep, for example, the spleen comes to rest to a great extent, but only in its own particular fashion. The spleen is the organ of sensation that allows the more spiritualized aspect of the human being to perceive the rhythm of food intake. And it speaks to the human subconscious, telling us what needs to be done to mitigate, at least in part, the damaging impact of unrhythmical eating. Thus, spleen activity works less in the direction of metabolism as such, and more in the direction of the rhythmic processes. It participates in rhythmic processes that must take place between food intake and respiration. An intermediate rhythm, provided by the spleen, is simply interposed between the rhythm of respiration and the intake of food, which otherwise does not tend to be especially rhythmical. Respiratory rhythm enables human beings to live within the strict rhythmicity of the cosmos. Our irregular food intake constantly disrupts this strict cosmic rhythm, and the spleen is the mediator. This state of affairs can actually be confirmed by simply observing the human being. Please do study anatomical and physiological details. You will find that all of this is confirmed down to the smallest detail. On the one hand, you will find proof of what I have said in how the artery to the spleen is almost directly connected to the aorta, and also externally in how the spleen is incorporated into the organism. On the other hand, you will find evidence that the spleen mediates in the direction of food intake in how the splenic vein is placed within the entire organism. It leads to the portal vein and is in direct connection with the liver. Here a rhythm that is half outer and half inner aligns itself with the lack of rhythm so that they regulate each other. The activity of the spleen is interposed between the rhythmic human being and the metabolic human being. Many symptoms that are related to improper spleen function can be put in order by building on the knowledge we have acquired about the connection between the respiratory system and the metabolism, or between the circulatory system and the metabolism as mediated by the spleen. It is not at all surprising that the physiology of the spleen is largely ignored by materialistic science, which knows nothing about the threefold human being, the metabolic human being, the circulatory human being, and the neurosensory human being. The end of Lecture 15.